We're happy to again, once again, be in the Lachman home, and this year, the whole series is in memory of their daughter, and we hope that this year and all the shiurim are li'ilui nishmata. But I wanted to specifically dedicate today's shiur, and specifically the topic that I chose for today's shiur, in memory of all of those who have been killed since Simchas Torah, and certainly the Chayalim, and specifically in our own neighborhood, the son of friends of ours, Binyamin Erli. I was able to visit them twice. And in one of the Shiva visits that I made, I was thinking, you know, this would be a good topic to discuss. I want to dedicate today's learning in memory of Binyamin, Zechrono Levracha, Hashem Yimkum Damo. And obviously we hope that the Torah should be l'ilui nishmaso and should continue to give his wonderful family and parents chizuk and love that they obviously need. The topic of Nichum Aveilim is actually a relatively big topic. We're going to condense it into one shiur, but in theory we could have expanded it into a 2 or 3 part series. And I want to give you an overview halachically. It'll include some hashkafa and also some practical advice. I'm not breaking any news if I mention that a lot of people have a hard time knowing how to make a shiva call. That's an expression that Americans use, at least some Americans use. Pay a shiva call, visit a shiva house, nichum aveilim. For me, at least, these are all synonymous terms. And a lot of people feel very awkward. They don't like going. And something that we will discuss in the continuation of this year, to put it bluntly, a lot of people don't know how to make a shiva call. A lot of people do really bad jobs at it. And it's because it's hard. And when people have, you know, it's hard and it's awkward and death is the big thing that no one likes to talk about, especially when it's a tragic death. So people often, even though I know everyone means well, but people sometimes avoid it, or don't know what to do, and sometimes say all sorts of inappropriate things. So we'll try, again, you can't account for everything. I won't solve all the world's problems with today's shiur, that I cannot do. But in the realm of Shiva, but hopefully a deeper understanding, the halachos, and even some practical advice from my many years of experience, I hope will be helpful. So to begin, what is the source for the idea of Nichum Aveilim? So the Gemara, in a number of places, quotes a pasuk in Devarim, Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Hei, where we are told to imitate Hashem. It's a different pasukim that you could use to source this, but maybe the most well-known is Achrei Hashem Elokeichem Telchu. You should imitate or follow, walk in the ways of God. And the Gemara obviously understands it can't be literal. What does that mean to walk in the way or follow Hashem? And the Gemara immediately explains that it means metaphorically that we should imitate the ways of Hashem, the midos of Hashem. And the Gemara gives a number of examples. But one of the examples the Gemara gives is just like Hashem was Menachem Aveilim, just like Hashem comforted the mourners, so too should we. And what's the source? There's more than one, if I'm not mistaken, example in the Chumash, where Hashem, so to speak, visits or comforts mourners. But if I recall correctly, I believe the proof text, which is in our recent Parshios HaShavua, is when Avram dies in Bereishis Perek Chav Hei. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes to bless Yitzchak, and that is seen as an example of coming to give the mourner comfort in the immediate aftermath. So that's the one source that the Gemara gives. Of course, there is also indirectly a very powerful source from Shlomo HaMelech in Koheles, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Beis. Somewhat shocking if you're not familiar with this Pasuk. Says Koheles, Tov Leilech LeBeis Evel MiBeis Mishneh. Better to go to a shiva house than to go to a wedding, which is really a shocking, perhaps, at first glance statement, certainly profound. And at minimum, it's yet another source for the mitzvah of paying a shiva call, being Menachem Aveilim. And I think it alludes to the fact that even though I mentioned, and it's obvious that for a lot of people it's hard, it can be awkward, it can be uncomfortable, but it can actually not only be a big mitzvah, my sense is that it doesn't just mean Tov Leilech LeBeis Evel because the mitzvah you're doing for the mourners is even more important than the mitzvah you're doing for the chasen kala on the receiving end. I think it does more for you. If you've ever, you know, this is certainly true about a funeral. Not every funeral. We've been to plenty of funerals where we're kind of looking at our watch. Sometimes that's the way that goes. But if it was a particularly special person, if we have the mazel that the people who are maspid are particularly good at that, which is its own separate discussion. Plenty of people don't know how to give a spade either. But if you're at it, but I've certainly been at many funerals in which I walked away, you know, beyond inspired. And I don't just mean the famous ones that are in the news. I mean, so even sometimes very simple people who live very normal, ordinary lives, and doesn't necessarily even mean that they died tragically, although sometimes those are very heartfelt experiences. But I've been at, you know, you go to a friend of yours, or you know, as a rabbi, somebody in the shuls, you know, 75 or 80-year-old or 90-year-old parent who passes away, you didn't know anything about them. But if the right people knew how to give the right hespedim, you leave thinking, wow. I said this to Lachman's at Shiva, so I'll repeat it again. Chaya Gittel's funeral was an example of that. Anyone who was there, it was obviously a terrible tragedy. But when you heard about how special this wonderful young woman was, you were uplifted. Tov le'alecha be'zevel. There was, you know, paying Shiva call, hearing her story, hearing, etc. You know, it's a chesed to the people who are sitting Shiva, obviously. But you can also do a lot for yourself when you do it the right way. So these are sources, the Gemara from, you know, from the Chumash, Koheles. Does that mean that this is a mitzvah d'oraisa? Or is that just like kind of a hint? So this is kind of a technical question, but I think it's actually an interesting question because it'll illuminate an aspect of the mitzvah. So this is a debate. It's a big debate in the Rishonim. Is Nicham Avelim, and you could put Nicham Avelim with Bikur Cholim and Hachnasas Orchim, those are the three that usually go together. The Gemara describes all of them. Imitate Hashem, V'haftarecha Kamocha, do these things. So some Mefarshim say that we should take these Gemaras, these Pesukim literally, that these are mitzvos from the Torah. Mitzvah d'oraisa. You have to keep Shabbos, you have to keep kosher, you have to keep Taras HaMashpacha, and you have to be Menachem Ovel. Some say it's actually a mitzvah d'oraisa. Others say this is just a hint, an asmachta, a remez. It's only rabbinic. The most interesting view in this, because it's at first glance difficult to understand, but it'll be an opportunity to get a deeper understanding, I think. The most interesting one is out of the Rambam. The Rambam seems to contradict himself within one sentence. The Rambam says at first that these mitzvos, including the ones that we're talking about today, paying a shiva kol, nichma velim, are rabbinic, are derabanan. However, the Rambam, after listing nichma velim and other examples, says that these are all michlal v'yahavta recha kamocha. They're all part of the pasuk of love your fellow Jew, v'yahavta recha kamocha. So the contradiction, the tension is obvious. Within one sentence, he said they're rabbinic. And then he said they're included in V'Havrecha Kamocha. Well, V'Havrecha Kamocha, last time I checked, even before it was a yeshiva boys choir song, right, it was a pasuk in the Chumash. So how could you say it's rabbinic if you're telling me it's part of V'Havrecha Kamocha? Which one is it? It's an obvious contradiction, or at least difficulty in the language of the Rambam. So I want to share with you two explanations, I think both of which are interesting, and one in particular I think really will be of profound insight. So the first one, which I think maybe is the simplest explanation, I've seen this in a number of sources, including in one of the Svarim of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, where he suggested, and we have examples of this a lot of times in Halacha, where you can have a broad category that comes from the Torah, and the rabbis, Chazal, were empowered to give you the detailed legislation and guidance of how to perform it. So, big adol, broad strokes, being compassionate, being a mensch, v'haftarecha kamocha, in the most abstract sense, that's a Torah value. Specifically, how do you fulfill that? Oh, you visit the sick, or you pay a visit to the mourner. How to do it? The rabbi told you what to do. So it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan. But the value, somehow up in Shemayim, you're getting like a double scorecard. You did the mitzvah d'rabbanan, but you're also checking a d'oraisa box. That's, I think, maybe on one level, the easiest explanation. However, many years ago, I saw something which I think also really touched me very much, and I want to share with you as a second explanation, from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. As that's all. Those of you who know in the neighborhood, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, so this is his father. If I'm not mistaken, this is in his book that he published on the Rambam, which was called Parach Mata Aaron, which, of course, is play on the psukim that describe in the story of Korach when Aaron's staff started blossoming with Shkedim. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik used that as the title of some of his books. Just as a side point, for those who know the story of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who was a staggering, staggering genius and one of the Gedolei Ador in America, at a relatively, you know, he was older, but a relatively young old age, he had a debilitating stroke. In the last many years of his life, half of his body, literally half of his body on one side was completely paralyzed and the other half worked. And despite that fact, he schlepped in from Chicago to New York for 2 days a week to be in Yeshiva University for years and years and years. When I got to YU, he was much older and had been for years already in this semi-paralyzed state and was still flying in every week. giving shurim. I had the zechus in my 10 years in YU. I was chavrusas with two of his grandsons. And because of that, I had an indirect connection to him. But despite how old he was and how infirm he was, it was dafke at that stage of life when I was already in YU. This was the last period of his life where he was writing these books. And he would sit there, and if you saw, I was able to, anyone could see because he wasn't like in private, but also because of my connection to his grandchildren, so I could see the notebooks. If you didn't know who was writing it or didn't read it, it looked like a little kid. He couldn't write in a straight line, and the letters were huge, you know, very big and different sizes. But that's because you had this, you know, man who was half paralyzed trying to write by hand in notebooks, which then turned into Sfarim. So I believe this is in one of those Sfarim. He also, a number of decades ago, a grandson passed away from Chicago, and he also wrote a Sefer on the laws of mourning in memory of the grandson. So this is probably in both of the Sfarim, but if I remember correctly, I saw this in Parach Mata Aaron, which is his Sefer on the Rambam. And he explained the Rambam as follows, that what the Rambam is saying is there's two levels of the mitzvah. There is, and you can fulfill them both simultaneously. There's the concrete, physical, if you will, practical mitzvah. You went and you gave to that person who was sitting shiva, that family that was sitting shiva. You comforted them. Again, we'll have to talk about a little bit, hopefully, how you do that, what you say, etc. But in addition to the verbal, physical, I went to the house. I sat down. I talked to them. I said hamakom. Whatever it is I did, that's the mitzvah, the manifestation of it that I did for them. Said Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, there's an additional element. Kiyum Shebelev. When you do things like that, it's also supposed to impact you. Where? In your heart. It's supposed to change you as a person. It's supposed to be an expression of, a development of, your humanity, your compassion, your sensitivity. So, said Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the mitzvah, the practical thing you're doing for the mourners, you went there, that's rabbinic. Rambam says it's a mitzvah derabanan. But when he says it's michlal, it's part of ha'afir ha'chamoch, he meant that in addition to the physical, practical manifestation, there's also an inner psychological, emotional dimension, spiritual dimension. That is the impact it has on you by making you, each time you do something like that, you become more compassionate, you become more loving. And that's a Torah obligation. So aside from being an interesting and very brilliant interpretation of the Rambam, more salient and more important for us to take away from that is that point. That each time you pay a shiva call, first and foremost, you're trying to help the person who's suffering, who's going to be sitting in front of you. Sometimes you go, there was a shiva, you know, someone in our, a member of our shul was sitting shiva, it seems like it was 100 years ago, because it was before Sukkot. But just 2 months ago, there was a woman in the shul sitting shiva, and going there, she actually was sitting alone, she had no relatives here. So going there was a chesed. Why should someone be, for someone to be alone for a week? On the other hand, the mother was very old. You know, it was one of those shivas where it wasn't sad. It was contemplative, it was reflective, but it wasn't sad. And then there are other shivas that are very different, as we know. But either one, you're doing a chesed. In whatever range it is, from the worst tragedy to the most natural, you know, pleasant death at 120 years, and everything in between, it's a chesed for the people when you go there, for sure. But don't lose sight of the fact that in many ways, it's more important for you than it is for them. This is the way we develop ourselves. This is the way we become bigger than who we are. The fact that for so many people it's actually hard is why it's even more important. That's the only way you grow. The only way you become better is to do the things that are hard, to do things that can be uncomfortable. And when it involves compassion and helping people, you know, the very fact that when it's a tragedy, again, like, for example, a soldier dying, right? It would be completely natural to be petrified to pay such a shiva call. What am I going to say? What's it going to be like? I get it. And that's why it's so important to go. Specifically, even an example of like a soldier, right? You don't have to worry. Anytime, Rahman al-San, a soldier would die or a victim of terror, no one's sitting alone. I don't just mean because there's an extended family, because there's often lines out the door for those kind of shiva houses. So it's not like you're going because if you don't go, what? It's still important to go because maybe you have a relationship with them. I know people who ask me for the shiva information for the Erlis who don't know them at all. That's also important to go, that they should see that Am Yisrael cares, even strangers came. What a huge, that's also kind of a comfort. Their best friends, the strangers, and everyone in between, it's a comfort. But it's also supremely important for you to do the things that are hard, because you know that that's how you become a more compassionate and sensitive person. And at least according to Aaron Soloveitchik, that is the Daraisa Kiyum of Nichem Avelim. Okay, that was point number two. Point number three is also very fascinating halachically, but I think also philosophically and hashkafically. And that is the following. Of anyone who has themselves sat Shiva or been in Avel at any point, and even if you haven't, you may know this, so you know that even though Shiva is 7 days and Shloshim is 30 days, but you don't actually do 7 complete days. Right? We have a halachic principle called Mitzas Hayom Kekulo. So people who sit Shiva pretty much in the morning, especially if there was a minion in the house, so usually it's after the minion, or even if there was no minion, so you know, relatively early that morning, you know, somebody comes, there could be guests who are there who came to visit, if there was a minion in particular, or sometimes I as the rabbi, or a rabbi will go on that last day. And then basically, as early, once it's already sunrise, and you've had at least one menachem come, a person can get up. Mixas ayam kukulo. But you can't get up, even on the, again, at the end of the 7th day, it's over. But in the beginning of the 7th day, you can't get up until someone has come to be menachem you. Why? If we have a principle called mitzvah sayom kekul, again, that's a little bit of a halachic hocus pocus. That's not our topic now, but it exists. There's such a thing called halachic hocus pocus, mitzvah sayom kekul. Sometimes a partial day counts as the whole day. But if that's true, and the Gemara quotes it, that's the halacha, so why do we need to wait for someone to come? I'll strengthen the question. At the end of Shloshim, there are certain halachos, even if it's not apparent, so Shloshim is very important because everything ends at Shloshim. And even if it is apparent and you're going to have a whole year, but there are certain stringencies in Shloshim. So we want to know when Shloshim ends. Shloshim also ends in the, quote, beginning of the 30th day. You don't have to keep the stringencies of Shloshim, or especially if it's not apparent, you don't have to keep Avelos all of the 30th day, just the beginning of the 30th day. What happens on the 30th day to trigger it ending? Nothing, just sunrise. We don't have this requirement that someone came or some action happened. So there's an inconsistency. For Shiva to end at the beginning of the 7th day requires someone to come. In and of itself, that's a little bit hard to understand. But it's especially hard to understand when you contrast that with Shloshim, where you don't require that at all. So Rav Soloveitchik, the older brother of Rav Aaron, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, explained in a shir, I think, very, very beautifully. And that is that this halachic hocus pocus, mitzvah hayom, is not necessarily automatic. It requires some nihug, some action, some behavior that's associated with whatever the thing we're talking about. Could be in the realm of the Beis HaMikdash and Karbanos, not our topic. Or this, you need some nihug. So in Shloshim, right, there's no mitzvah of visiting a person during Shloshim. Again, common sense, just like you might visit someone who you know is lonely or a homebound person, and that's a mitzvah called chesed. So obviously if you know someone who's 2 or 3 weeks ago lost a relative, they're not all of a sudden magically happy because it happened 2 weeks ago. It's still a nice thing. But there's no thing, we don't call that nicham aveilim. It's called chesed to visit someone who you know might be lonely or tired or sad or whatever the reason is. So when so Shloshim itself does not have this dimension of the visit, of the nicham aveilim. It's really something for the avel him or herself. So the very fact that the avel him or herself woke up on the 30th day, and whatever it is they didn't do because it's Shloshim, already now it's over. Because that the definition of Shloshim, which are things that the avel does or doesn't do him or herself, it happened even for a millisecond on the 30th day. But here's the point I want to get to, where Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that you see from this halacha so profoundly, is that evidently in Shiva, the visit is part of the avelos. It's not just that I have the avel has his or her mitzvah to sit Shiva. They sit on a low chair, they don't wear leather shoes, etc. They have their halachos. They're not necessarily bathing the way they normally would. They have their halachos, and they have their mitzvah, I should say, and I have my mitzvah to visit them. Right? For the first 15 minutes of the shir, I would have thought that there are two different mitzvos. Sarah Soloveitchik, you see from this something, I think, very profound. That the mitzvah that we have to be menachem, to pay the Shiva call, is actually part of the mitzvah of Avelos itself. It's not just our mitzvah, it's part of their experience. Our visit is part of the experience. And I think that that brings two points to the fold. One is that even the Torah's conception of mourning, and there's a mitzvah to mourn. Right? It wouldn't be courageous or anything admirable for someone not to mourn. We would think that there would be a cruelty in that. It's a mitzvah to mourn. But part of the mitzvah is to be comforted. That's deep. Not everyone's ready, not everyone's, you know, obviously there's different types of deaths, different situations. But the process that the avel or avelim go through, and knowing that they're not alone, and that people are coming and doing is not only our mitzvah, it's part of their mitzvah. It's also important for us to realize that when we pay a shiva visit, it's not us just comforting them. I think it also highlights the fact that every death of a Jew is a communal tragedy too. You can't compare what the family goes through to anyone else, obviously. But even if it's a shminas sheba shminas, even a pale percentage of it, but every death, obviously the tragic ones especially, but every death, right? Just like if you're Mekayim Nefesh Achas, it's Olam Malei. If you save one person, right? So the loss of every one person is a loss for all of us. And therefore, there are two mitzvos, but they're actually intertwined. And therefore, said Rav Soloveitchik, you can't finish Shiva unless there was a little bit of a nechama that day. Each day, part of the mitzvah of the Shiva, of the Avelis, is that someone visited. So yes, you don't have to spend all day until sunset. You can get up in the morning, but only if there was a visitor. Only if there was a Menachem, because that is part of the mitzvah. Another interesting idea, before we get to some of the practical ways of doing Shiva call, is another interesting idea that some of the post-Gim, including Rav Moshe Feinstein and others, point out, but it really goes back to a Rambam. And that is, who are we doing chesed for when we pay a Shiva call, when we visit? Who are we doing chesed for? So the obvious answer is the people who are sitting Shiva, the Avelim. We already mentioned that we're doing something for ourselves, although I wouldn't necessarily call it a chesed for ourselves. It's avodas Hashem. It's an important thing to develop our midos and our benam lechavero and our compassion, etc. But I wouldn't call that chesed. But who are we doing chesed for? So the obvious answer is doing chesed for the people we're visiting. Sometimes it's a spouse. Sometimes it's rachmana litzlan. Sometimes it's parents, children in the normal situation, siblings, etc. You're doing a chesed for them. You visited them. That's obviously true. But there is another, so to speak, person who we're doing chesed for, and this comes from a statement that the Rambam makes. The Rambam wonders the following question. And again, some of you who've studied, whether you've studied Gemara or just Halacha over the years, you know that sometimes on the books, we sometimes come up with all sorts of hypothetical situations, which are not necessarily so common, but the hypothetical situations are intended to, you know, bring out a point, elicit a principle, if you will. So sometimes you have like wild, like completely unrealistic situations. This one is not like wild and completely fantastical, but it's still not going to be so typical. Although it could happen, this is not unrealistic, it could happen, but more important than the specifics is the point it brings out. What am I referring to? The Rambam says, what happens if you can only do one thing? You can either go to 1/1, whatever street, and pay a shiva call, or you can go to 1/2 and visit a chola. There's two mitzvahs. One family sitting shiva, one person is sick, I don't have time to do both, I can only do one. Which mitzvah comes first? What would you think? Why? Well, because that's the topic of today's year?
No, because you said you pay shiva call before you can go to a chasana, so...
I didn't say before, I said tov lelech. Well, but okay, fine, okay. So we have one vote for shiva call. That's fine, that's okay. You're allowed to vote. who agrees that shiva house is more important? You should go to shiva house.
Shiva, because that person can never... you're doing a mitzvah that, not for something in return.
Good, okay, good, fine. Anyone else want to argue that Bikur Cholim is more important?
I think that might be more important. The person's still alive, and to help him get better. The one for Nichum Avelim, there'll be other people coming in.
Maybe,
want to help him get better.
I could hear both arguments. I really hear both. What I never would have guessed is not the decision of the Rambam. There's only two possibilities, so we could easily guess. He has to pick one of them. But it's the reason of the Rambam, which is the shocking thing. The Rambam says that the Shiva call comes first. But why? Says the Rambam, because when you pay a Shiva call, you're doing chesed for both the living and the dead. Says the Rambam something astounding. That when you pay a Shiva call, when you're Menachem Avelim, the neshama of the niftar is there. And you're bringing comfort not only to the people sitting there, that's maybe equal to the person who's sick, but there's a whole other person at the Shiva house. And that is the person who passed away. And that's already in the Rambam. More recently, commenting on this, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in one of his tshuvas, explains that the source of this idea, that there's two dimensions of the Shiva call. One is helping ease the pain of the mourners, honoring the family, giving them the chama, and then you're doing it also for the mace. You're also doing it for the deceased. You're also doing it for the niftar. And he gives an example, where he suggests, where did the Rambam know this from? What's the source of the Rambam? There's no Gemara that asked that question. So where would the Rambam have got this point from? A very powerful halacha, which is actually in a Gemara, which I once in my life experienced. Let's say someone dies, Rachmana Litzlan, with no relatives. Now, this could happen in less extreme situations. You could have somebody who lived to a ripe old age who was never married, lived to a ripe old age and never had children.
My aunt died like that.
Huh?
My aunt died like that. Well, she only, my father was her brother who died before her.
Was she married?
And she was never married.
Okay, so that's exactly.
It was very sad.
Your father had died beforehand.
My father died before. We were very close to her, but like.
Right. So you could imagine those are the kind of scenarios where this would happen, which are objectively sad even before the death. For someone that lived that kind of lonely life. But okay, that's part of real life. We know that there are people who have that difficult lot in life. So what's the halacha when that person dies? What do you do? Do you remember what you did with your aunt? I'm not trying to put you on your spot.
No, I know. I'm saying we did things with Zecha for her. I mean,
I'm sure you did, whether you remember it or not, I'm sure.
But we didn't do any, there was no sitting.
Are you sure? You'll go back and ask your family. It's a Gemara Masechta Shabbos. It's a din explicitly in Shulchan Aruch. We have a Sheva house. And the people from the community come, Sheva Minyan, every day sitting there.
But who would be at the Sheva house?
I think
maybe part of the problem is she'd live, none of us live.
If you couldn't, I'm telling you that I was part of this once.
Would they
stay Kaddish? No, that's a separate point. I'm talking about the Sheva house. No, it's more than that. So I'm telling you, there was somebody, my wife will remember the person, even though you didn't know him so well, but somebody I was very close with all the years I was a Talmud in YU, named Rabbi Yosef Wanevsky. Rabbi Wanevsky himself was, from a very young age, was blind. He wasn't born completely blind, but he had some degenerative thing. By the time I knew him, he'd been blind for decades. I don't know if he had any siblings. If he had siblings, they had predeceased him. He never got married. He had a very, very hard life, obviously, lived alone. But he had an incredible simchas chaim. I don't want to spend time now talking about how special he was. But he was an incredibly special person. And he was beyond brilliant. He had a virtual photographic memory. So despite being blind, he had gotten a PhD in Jewish history. And he knew all of Shas. He was a walking encyclopedia. So by the time I got to YU, he was I think the community / YU kind of helped support him. He lived on his own, not that far from YU. He would spend the day either in the Beis Medrash or mostly in the library, and people would just talk to him. He had a shaila. You could ask him. He knew everything. People would sit and learn with him. They would read and talk to him. And I became very close with him to the point that he got a bracha under our chuppah. Mm-hmm. A few years later, he passed away. And we arranged, when I say we, was under the leadership of one of the Rebbeim at YU, Rabbi Heshi Reichman, some of you may know the name, the father of Rabbi Zev Reichman from Englewood. He has a son-in-law who lives in Mishkafayim, a daughter and a son-in-law who live in Mishkafayim. He's a big tzaddik, Rabbi Reichman, and he had been very involved in helping this Rabbi Wanevsky all the years. He arranged. We had people sitting every single day, that there should be people in the house. It was spooky. It was weird. I'm not... It should be very rare. Halavai, it's very rare that you even need to do that.
Did you free up?
No. But we did a shiva. We sat... Yes, we did. We made sure every day... There are people there.
But nobody was sitting shiva in the shiva chair.
That I can't remember, but I think so. It doesn't matter who. It has to be a minion of people there.
No, but I'm saying a minion of people came and just talked, but no one's sitting on the...
I said to you, I don't remember that carefully enough.
Shiva chair, not wearing shoes?
I don't remember, and it's not the point.
I'm sorry. Right, but then amongst each other, but none of that.
What I'm trying to explain to you is that why do we do this? And it's so, I did it only once in my life, and it was almost 30 years ago, so I don't remember the nuances of what you're describing. I could look it up, but I don't remember. But the more important point, or Moshe Feinstein makes this point. He says, why is this? This is not something made up. This is in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch that you do that. And so to Moshe, you see from this, and this is the Rambam source, because it's not just the mourners. The mace is there. Somebody passes away, they're there for that week. And therefore we go, and we make sure there's a presence there. There's no relatives to Menachem, or being Menachem the Niftar.
Is that why you're not supposed to sleep in their bed?
I don't know. That's true, but I don't want to get into that. Anyway, okay, so that's again, I think, another very profound point, that when you go to a Shiva house, in a more normal situation, there can be multiple Avelim. That's obviously 99% of the time. There are Avelim. You're not only doing it for them. You're also doing it for the Nifter, him or herself. Okay, let's talk about one of the halachos that some people either know about and trip over or don't even know about. That is, the Gemara tells us in Masechet Moed Katan, it is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, and the source is a pasuk in Sefer Iyov, that when you pay a shiva call, you are not supposed to start talking. You're supposed to wait for the Avel to start speaking. So this is a somewhat well-known halacha, but often not observed, and sometimes not even known. So first, let's discuss some of the practical exceptions to the rule, and let's then try to understand what it's all about. So first of all, you should just be aware that even if there really was no talking, you would be allowed to say hamakom. Right? We're not referring to the hamakom, we're talking about other types of conversation. That's point number one. Again, it's rare that this happens, but you should just be aware of that. Number two is, a lot of times you come into the shiva house, and the avel is in the middle of a conversation with somebody else. You don't have to wait for the tafka to speak to you. Once you see that they're already in conversation, then you are allowed to jump in. Okay, so you don't have to feel guilty if you ever did that. That's totally allowed. Next, this is something very fascinating that I saw in the name of a number of poskim, including the Chazon Ish, which is that sometimes you know that there are people who are shy, who are more introverted. And if you are sure, if you can tell that the reason that the person is not speaking is simply because it's hard for them, not because they're making some decision, I don't want to talk now, but they're just at a loss for words, or there maybe it's awkward for them, etc., then you are allowed to initiate. They bring down that there are Chazon Ish very often when he would pay shiva calls, people would be so in awe that he came that they couldn't start speaking. Then what do you say to the Chazon Ish? So he would just start speaking because he understood that the situation demanded that. Nevertheless, we're going to get to the issue of inappropriate speech in a second. My wife knows. It's like my number one pet peeve in the whole world. I got stories. Oh, I have stories. Oh, yeah.
No, not more than my
one. Okay, we're not competing. Because if we would be competing, it would be a race to the bottom. So let's not do that. But nevertheless, broadly speaking, a lot of people are not careful with this halacha. Sometimes you come in, let's say for you it was good at 1 in the afternoon or 2 in the afternoon. There are times during the day which is quiet, not that many people, not that much traffic, or there are certain, not a lot of availim. There are times when people come in, the house is quiet. For sure, it doesn't happen always. It's not going to happen when you're visiting the family of a soldier. But, anyway, and people talk. They don't need, either they don't know the halacha, or it's just too awkward for them to be quiet. Because most people cannot bear to be alone with their own thoughts. So like they need to talk for their own insecurities. So people are not so careful. It's halacha and the Gemara. It's a pasuk already in Tanakh. So there's different theories that, to so to speak, explain the whole premise of this, and maybe to defend a little bit the lack of observance of this. So one theory, which is really hard to understand, but it's actually a very early theory, going back to the Lavush, that was a few hundred years ago. He was a contemporary of the Rama. So he suggests, based on sources even before him, that you want to wait for the Avel to speak because you have to make sure that the Avel is sad and wants Nechama. So once you hear them speaking in that vein, then you can then pick up and do whatever the Nichum hopefully you'll do. Now, it's very, very hard to understand, like, why are we worried that he's not going to be, like, I think I told you this in a different shir. I once helped a family or a woman whose elderly mother passed away, and I think I may have told you, it was one of the most painful experiences of my entire rabbinate, was to see how not sad she was that her mother died. I'm not judging her. Her comment to me was, "Mother, since I was 12, I mothered her. I took care of her. She was no mother. The first day of rest I have in 50 years that she passed away." So it was heartbreaking. I'm not judging anybody, not the mother, not the daughter, but that was heartbreaking. But that's not typical, obviously. So in a normal situation, you're not sure they're sad? It seems weird. I'm just telling you, but this is what the Lavush brings down. So he says, if that's the case, if that's the reason why the halacha is you wait for them to speak so you can tell. So if you know without them speaking that they're sad, either A, because sometimes people are crying, or because you're at the funeral and they were very sad then, or it's just because it's obvious, duh, of course they're sad. So then he says there's no reason to wait. The whole purpose of waiting was to see if they were sad. Now, My personal take on this, which I think is a good lesson, Bechlal, is what you can really take from this, because I find this a very weird answer, but I think the more broad point is one of the reasons it's good to let the Avel start is because people do mourn in different ways. People are not the same. Not only are people different, day to day, hour to hour, people are in a different mood. It's not static. And it's not about you, it's about them. So by you waiting for them to start, they're going to give you a clue as to what type of conversation they want to have. We've all been at shiva houses where all they want to do is talk about mom or dad or Nebuch child or whatever. And they're just with stories and pictures. Okay, so you run with that. And sometimes they're talking about broader things in history. Who knows what? But you have to let them set the tone. It's not about you, it's about them. So I think that's the broader point. But as a reason for why maybe people start talking, even though the halacha is you're not supposed to start. So one explanation is, well, if you know that they're sad, there's no reason not to start. But there's other explanations, which is that a lot of poskim say it doesn't mean every single person. That's the mistake. The whole premise of this is a mistake. Some poskim say every day is a different halacha. So each day, once the avil's already talked, so that carries you for the rest of the day. You know they're in the mood to talk. They talked an hour ago. They've been in conversation since 8 o'clock in the morning. And now you came at 1 o'clock. That's one. Others say it's for the whole shiva. So once they started talking in the beginning of shiva, that's okay. So there are reasons to, so to speak, defend or rationalize the practice that some people have of just talking without waiting for the avel. And you can definitely find people who defend that practice. But again, I think the broader point, even if we're, and this is a good segue to what I want to get to, which is what not to say, what to say. But the broader point of waiting, even if technically you get there and they're already talking to somebody else, or you want to rely on these opinions and say, well, they started talking at 8 a.m, so I can continue now. That there's what to rely on for that. But the more important point is, maybe this is obvious, but it's not obvious because I've seen so many ridiculous things in shiva houses. You need to go with an abundance of emotional intelligence. And listening is more important than talking. Most of us, and I include myself, are not going to have so many pearls of wisdom that your words are going to make the difference. Even if you say something sensitive and thoughtful, which is like maybe a 50% chance you're going to do that, if I just look at all the shiva houses I've been at. But even if you do say something thoughtful, it's really your presence and your ear that are giving the nechama, not your mouth. Just being there is the ultimate statement, which is why if you sat there for 5 minutes and didn't say a word, it's a mitzvah, because you came, number one. Number two is, in many cases, at various points and in various ways, but the other wants to talk. That is what gives him or her the nechama, to talk to you about their loved one, that you should know them, you should understand them. So that's not you talking. Every time you're talking, that means the other isn't. Are you sure that what you're saying is so important and is going to be so comforting? The listening is the key. That's the message to take from this. Technically speaking, of course, most of the time you are going to say something and sometimes you will initiate. But realize that what you're really there is to give comfort by your mere presence and by giving them opportunities to talk. The more you're talking and not listening, you're already in minus. That's not easy for people. First of all, because some of us just like to talk. And also, it's a way we deal with the nervousness. But that's on you. You need to work on that. Because what's really important for them is not hearing you babble, but letting them talk and share. And asking open-ended questions that will elicit information that might be meaningful, especially if it's someone you didn't know. Right? Sometimes we go to the shiva house and we knew the niftar and nifteret. But many times we go because it's our friend's parent or our friend's whatever. We didn't necessarily know them, or we knew them a little bit. So let me focus on this pet peeve of mine. First, I'll tell you, if you're interested, if you want some humor and uplifting, light moment, which we all need these days, after the shiur, you go on YouTube, and if you Google, you know, what not to say at a shiva house, you will find what I think is the single most funny YouTube video ever made. if YouTube was invented for only this video, Dayenu. I hadn't listened. I checked last night. It's 10 years old. I hadn't seen it in years. And I laughed for the first time maybe in 6 weeks last night by myself in my office after midnight. And it's these two or three yeshiva guys who are dressed up. And you cannot but help like cry with laughter because the things they say are so stupid, so absurd, and so realistic. I don't want to give you examples of it. It's so good. You know. Yeah, exactly. So you didn't get a second opinion? I mean, people say the most inane things. I had a chavrusa with your father for 30 years. You know what hurts me the most? I won't be able to finish shas with him. I'm not doing it justice. I cannot tell you how insightful and how funny this is. And of course, it's funny because it's true. So if you're ever not sure what to say, first watch that video. And you'll learn, okay? I can also give you one example for myself. I had many examples where it was just bizarre, like just totally unrelated conversations. But the most extreme example I think I ever had was, I won't tell you the neighborhood, but it was, I was living in Baltimore at the time, but it was someone from Baltimore was sitting shiva out of Baltimore. And I went out of town to pay the shiva call. And it was objectively a tragic situation, okay? It was a single high school age person who died, who wasn't sick before he died. So it was objectively a very difficult situation. Anyway, I'm sitting. I came for one of the siblings, and the father was there. The mother in particular really almost couldn't function during the shiva. It was so, the grief was so overwhelming. But we're sitting, we're having a conversation about the niftar and whatever it was. And then some woman comes in, very big sheitel. Fancy, anyway. And while she's talking, she notices that there's some other yeshiva boys, friends of the niftar, who were there. And she notices, well, she says, 1 second. Didn't you just win the raffle from such and such yeshiva? Was that you? You look like the guy I saw. You won the raffle, right? It was $100,000. A single guy, you won the raffle? Are you dating? This conversation happened at a shiva house. I did everything in my power not to just lose it on these people. And this, now 20 years later, you see how bothered I am. Mm-hmm. The level of inappropriateness, I don't even have words to describe how horrible and cringe this experience was. So most people aren't going to do that. But we might be guilty of things to some degree, right? When I'm all this, watch the YouTube video, remember my story, and think of all the other examples you've heard of. The main point is, when you go to the shiva house, first of all, it's not about you. Okay, shkoyach. But also, it's not about everything else. It's supposed to be about the niftar and the avelim. Now, sometimes, the avel wants to talk about anything else, but they start asking you, oh, how are your kids? How's this? I try to indulge in that a little bit. First of all, you don't want to be rude. Plus, sometimes people need an escape. That is the comfort. But I always, always try as quickly as possible to bring the conversation back. Right? Sometimes I know people have that relief. I get the points, I made the shiva call, and it wasn't even hard because they just asked me about my grandkids or whatever. It's a mistake. I'm not saying it's not a mitzvah. You went, you were there. But that's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be to talk about the avel, to give the family a chance to have nechama about that. Now, if in that moment or that particular avel needed an escape, okay, so you're not going to force them. But you should try. You should always try to bring it back. I try to do that myself. And again, I don't think I'm particularly talented at it or insightful. I just try, especially if I didn't know. I just try to ask basic questions. Oh, where was your father from? How did your parents meet? You just ask a few of those questions. I don't ask, had they die? Were you there at the end? Did you get a second opinion? I don't just mean the bad ones. I mean, you don't even have to go there. It's not necessary. If they want to tell you, they'll tell you. That stuff. But just so you should get to, you know, if you knew them, it's even easier. it was a friend of yours, or you really knew the relative. You talk, you share memories. There's, in my experience, the two things that give the Avel the most happiness, number one is when they get to tell you about their loved one. But number one, that's really number two. Number one is when you share something that you know about their loved one. Now, sometimes you don't know anything about them. You're just going because it's your friend's, you know, or your neighbor's parent. Okay, so even then you can do a lot. Just ask. What did your mom do for a living? Did she work out of the house or she was just a homemaker? Where did she grow up? She went, oh, how did she meet your dad? Just open things like that. It doesn't have anything to do with the sickness. It doesn't have anything to do with the death. Well, maybe they want to talk about it, maybe they don't. But they'd be happy to tell you about their mother or their father or whoever. And if you knew about the person, so you could still ask questions. You didn't know everything about the person. Maybe this was a good friend of yours from the neighborhood, but you don't know what they were like when they were 20 years old and they were 18 years old. There's still things to ask. But if you have something you can share, if you happen to have been, not every time you do by Shivako, you're at the funeral. But if you're at the funeral and you're actually listening, hopefully, most of the time, even if not all the Hespedim were great, at least some of them were meaningful, we hope at least, you will learn something. Like, I'm giving you an example, I'm not patting myself on the back at all. I'm just giving you an example of something that was helpful. Right? So we know the Erlis, we live near them in Ramat Shiloh for forever, 10 plus years. But we haven't stayed really in touch since we moved to this neighborhood. Yeah, right away they knew who we were. I mean, we had been friendly with them. But I hadn't seen Binyamin in a few years. But I was at the funeral, like many thousands of other people standing in the rain for almost 2 hours. I was there, listening to everything. I learned a lot. So when I went, I was able to visit twice already. But when I went, so first of all, I was happy to hear the parents talking and sharing with me. But one of the things that I heard, if anyone who heard the eulogies, no, they talked about his particular love and volunteering on a farm. And I couldn't even, this wasn't like a gimmick. I didn't even really chop, like, what were they talking about? At what point in his life did he get into the farm? So at one point, when I was sitting with them, I said, you know, I just said that, first of all, you know, it was a remarkable, you know, funeral, and what a tribute, and I was amazed by you, and I learned so much. I said, but can you tell me, I didn't know, what was the story with that farm? Like, how did he get it? They were so happy to talk about it. I'm not patting myself on the back. All I did was listen and give them an opportunity to talk about something that gave their son happiness, and talking about things that made their son happy brings them the challah. I didn't say anything meaningful. I just asked a question. And as long as you think about it in advance, you just ask a few open-ended questions. If you know something, use that to ask a good question. If you knew a particular stuff, if you knew the person, even better. But even if you didn't, just ask general questions. Give them an opportunity to talk about the person. And don't think, even if it's a tragic death, let alone if it wasn't a tragic death, don't think that it has to be that we're talking about that. The Shiva call doesn't have to be talking about the death. Again, it can be if the Avel would want. That would be a reason to wait for the Avel to... They want to talk about that, that's one thing. But most of them don't. That's the last thing they want to talk about often. But they want to talk about the life, the person, the personality. So just give them the opportunity and listen. The more listening, the less talking, the bigger the mitzvah. Okay, we have a few more minutes, and I just want to end with two more things. First of all, when you do pay the visit, we know that there is a minhag, which is brought down, of saying Hamokom Yinachem Eschem, when you leave. So first of all, that's not in place of hopefully having a conversation with them, but in and of itself, maybe part of the mitzvah, and it's certainly a nice, wonderful thing to say at the end. There are different minhagim about whether you should be sitting or standing when you say Hamakom. So whichever one you've done or do, it's okay. I could give you this many gedolim had the minhag to do it sitting. This many gedolim had the minhag doing it standing. I don't think it necessarily matters. And it might depend on the situation. But either way, being able to say that is very, very meaningful. We do use the plural language, Hamakom Yinachem Eschem, even when there's only one mourner. And that might very well be because of what we said before, that the niftar is there. Yeah?
Should the mourner be sitting? Because I've heard people say, why don't you sit down so I can say Hamakom?
So the answer is that is preferred, because in general it's preferred. But you don't have to make them sit down. I would not ask them to sit down. If they happen to be standing anyway, I'll give you an example. This happens a lot for men. If you're there for the minyan, and you have to run out right after mincha, right after shacharis, and you don't have to wait. Again, most, you're right that in most cases, the avel themselves, I've seen this a lot, the avel will immediately go to sit down because they know that people want to leave or whatever. It is probably better if they're sitting. But you don't have to ask them to be sitting. Definitely not. I want to add also that there is a more recent practice, maybe more in Israel than in America, I'm not sure, that people add veloto sifu l'da'ava od. Should have no more pain. So some people don't like it because they think, ooh, it's modernish, it's somehow new. So I actually saw in a sefer, of all things, that someone asked Rav Chaim, that asked Rav Yashiv about it. He said, oh, it seems nice. So they said to him, but isn't this something that the modernim did? He said, don't be b'shageyami, it's a beautiful bracha. He was annoyed, like, you see, what are you, an idiot? What can be bad about giving someone a bracha? They shouldn't have any more pain. So I don't know if I've ever said it, because I didn't grow up saying it, but in Israel you hear that a lot. Okay, wonderful. But that's not instead of hamakom, but if you want to say it also, okay, good day. Last but not least is the question of if you can't go in person. And so this is a discussion that goes back decades already. Can you pass shiva call over the phone? So it's really a very technical question. Like, is it a, what, you know, can you do it? Well, of course you can. What does that mean? And is it a bad thing? How could it be a bad thing? The question is it count as the mitzvah of nichum avelim? Or does that require in person? So that's actually an interesting discussion. Rav Huttner actually had a letter on this many decades ago, and he said very strongly, "Ein mitzvah zu mitkayemes." You did not fulfill the mitzvah if you're not there in person. And he thinks really, you know, you did something, but it's not more than that. Rav Asher Weiss, I saw more recently, Rav Asher Weiss also felt that to officially be nichum avelim, it has to be in person. It's chesed if you called. It's not a bad thing. It's v'afler chakamokha. It's chesed. But the mitzvah of nichum avelim, dafka has to be in person. Nevertheless, despite those two opinions, there is a well-known tshuva of Moshe Feinstein where he has a little bit, slightly more moderate view. And he says, listen, it's obviously better on many levels to go in person, but he thinks it is a partial fulfillment of the mitzvah. He says, if you can't be there in person, he thinks it is a, you know, it's not the best way of fulfilling the mitzvah, but he does think there is a, he says it's not a mitzvah shalema, that's the way he used the term. But he thinks it's really better if you can go in person, obviously, in particular because of this theme we've mentioned now a few times, that's not only about the avel, it's also about the niftar. And again, that's already a little bit hocus-pocus, heebie-jeebie, mystical stuff, but the mystical part is the avel's in the house. The avel's not on the phone. I mean, the niftar, excuse me, the neshama is in the house, not on the phone. So by going to give comfort, to give company to the neshama, that really you cannot, everyone agrees you're not going to get that on the phone or in a letter or in a fax or nowadays a WhatsApp or something like that. I would add also that, you know, all the things we're talking about, like being able to listen in the right way, to be able to be sensitive to the nuances and the nonverbal cues, all of that is almost impossible over the phone. It's always going to be better if you can do it in person. So it's not only better for the neshama in the mystical way, for the avel and the avelim sitting there, it's better if you're there in person. I think it's obvious we know that. It's not nothing if you make a phone call if you can't come, and especially if you're they're in England or they're in America and you're in Israel or vice versa, of course you can't come, and no one expected you to come. So don't say, since I can't come, therefore I won't do anything. No, of course, in that case, you make a phone call. So it really is, it's context. Better to be in person, but I think there is some mitzvah, and it may even be, according to Moshe Feinstein, a mitzvah of nicham avelim if you do it over the phone. Yes.
Are you allowed to say that the pasuk the whole year that there are avelim? Because sometimes you don't see a person like for 2-3 months, and you found out that their parents.
It's an interesting question. I never thought about it. I don't think I would say it. I mean, you can be menachem people. You could definitely. Maybe, yeah, I think so. There is a halacha, it is brought down. If you couldn't get there during the shiva, but you see them afterwards, I think so. I think the answer is yes. Again, at some point it becomes awkward. You know what I'm saying? There are ways to just say, I'm so sorry about your mother, I didn't, you know, I was in Florida for the last 6 months, I just got back, or there are ways to do that without saying hamakom, but I don't think anything wrong with it. No, nothing wrong with it at all. And again, your question is good, the question of the telephone or the letter, it's all good, but I'm pointing out, it's almost a technicality, because it's obviously chesed. So at minimum, it's that, and 100%. And again, I think people understand. Again, sometimes we just drop the ball. I mean, let's be honest. Sometimes we could have gotten there earlier and we didn't. Okay, but still better to do it now than later. Better than ever. And second of all, sometimes we really couldn't. We were far away. We were busy. You know, and people, most people are normal and they understand, especially if you really had a good excuse. So 100%. Again, the longer you wait, the more awkward it'll be for you and for them. That's just human nature. So obviously you want to go as soon as you can in that regard. Okay?